Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll keep plunging through the crazy mire of the cultures of consciousness. Today we're going to be talking about one of the greatest, most controversial, most confusing, and in many ways most amusing figures of the 60s counterculture, Timothy Leary, who we'll be talking about with author Are You Serious, who's just published a book, Timothy Leary's Trip Through Time, which is really a delight in many ways, and not only just for its clarity and opinion and lightness in tone, but for the work that it does, not so much to rehabilitate Timothy Leary, although he certainly can use a lot of rehabilitation given the enormous amount of sort of foolish assumptions and stereotypical notions that surround him and have surrounded him throughout his undoubtedly problematic, checkered, excessive, contradictory, and sometimes banal career. Nonetheless, what the book puts forward that's particularly important is Leary's importance as a thinker. And this is often what gets lost in the story, even for those who are a fan of his proselytizing of LSD, his role as this kind of countercultural trickster sage, even the sort of tremendous drama of his life, which is amazing that it's not been turned into a film. That on top of all that, what sticks with me the most about Leary and why I continue to think about him and continue to read him is his work as a thinker. In many ways, he was a very prophetic conceptualist and sort of stand-up philosopher, looking forward towards our world of deep immersion in the digital, of anticipating many, many transhumanist ideas and possibilities, looking forward towards a world of cognitive liberty, of hedonic engineering, which in some ways defines many of the things that we're, the ways in which we're exploring the human sensorium, even as it becomes an object of surveillance and control in ways that he also would be very attuned to in terms of resistance and outright mockery when possible. So for these reasons and many others, I'm very happy to talk about him once again with RU, but before we bring on Mr. Serious, not that kind of serious, who has been with us before in Expanding Mind, I want to bring on our co-host here, Maja Dao. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Did you ever have the opportunity to see Timothy Leary do one of his presentations?
No, not in real life, although I've watched a lot of footage of it, but I was never able to attend, unfortunately. I enjoyed his speaking very much. He was powerful speaker, and for all of his irresponsibility, sort of, I feel like, you know, he was a mind breaker opener, you know, like it or not. I mean, he made it through, he helped push through paradigms. So whatever else you have to say about him, you can't take that away, you know.
Yeah, I was lucky. I met him very briefly. I didn't get to hang out with him as much as some other people I know, and I'm always a little sad about that. But I did get to meet him and see him speak on a number of occasions, and it always reminded me that he sort of compared his skills as a public speaker to a baseball player, which is that, you know, he might only really hit with something profound, you know, one third of the time, but that's, you know, that's batting over 300. That's not so bad.
That's so pretty good. You know, I mean, if you can get one in your lifetime, right? I mean, hey.
You know, so there was something also about seeing him in person or just getting a sense of the way that he held space that really explained a lot about what he was doing as well. And of course, he ended up in your town of Los Angeles there for the last, decade or two of his life, and it was really quite a nexus of a lot of really interesting L.A. music, subculture, hipster happenings, particularly in the 1990s, but I think that's probably a tad before your time in the town.
Just a smidge.
Yeah, a smidge. A smidge, a tad. Well, with a smidge and a tad, let's welcome Are You Serious to the program. Hey, man, how's it going?
I'm doing well. Good to hear from both of you.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. I always love it. You have a very particular quality to your voice. There's an impish, mischievous leprechaun hidden in there.
I'm not trying. It's just, it must just come out that way, you know.
Well,
probably why I don't often get hired by mainstream projects, no matter how straight I try to appear.
Well, it's a sad a truth that seems to be in this world so often, is that, you know, when you kind of stick to certain ideals, sometimes you just remain marginalized. And, you know, I applaud you on sticking to your ideals through all the writing career and everything you've done since Mondo 2000, and you know, keeping the freak flag flying. And I know sometimes it can be a lonely and frustrating process, but I really appreciate it, and I think people are going to appreciate this book. I mean, I'm really happy that younger people who maybe hear about Leary, they don't know about him, they see this big kind of tedious looking biography on the shelf, they're like, I don't know if I can do that. But now they have something that's, you know, accessible, short, but also full of ideas and inspiration, and a very nice encapsulation of an incredibly dramatic and rich life. But I want to ask you, you know, you wrote this for, or, you know, as sort of part of the estate. And that's a little odd, you know, because usually we think of like, oh, you're going to write about a figure, you want to have objectivity, you want to have, like, be sitting inside of it. And here, in some ways, you're very consciously writing a kind of defense of Leary and a sort of insistence on his importance even beyond his role as a cultural figure during the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s as well. So talk about that decision to kind of work, you know, kind of to put forward a more explicit defense of him as an important 20th century thinker and figure.
Sure. Well, they were planning a website. They are planning a website. And they wanted a timeline of his activities, his philosophical activities, as well as the events of his life. And as we discussed it, we realized that it couldn't be handled in brief bullet points. It's just too complex, too confusing, too weird. Many things require at least some explications. So it became clear that it had to be longish. And then as I was getting into it, it became clear that it really should be made available in a book format. So, I mean, that was pretty much the very simple genesis of the thing. I mean, it was written for, the Leary estate. On the other hand, I think Dennis Berry, who manages the Leary estate, came to me because she knew I wouldn't be a total suck-up, which would have been boring. You know, a hagiography would have been dull. A sort of psychedelic Superman comic book would have been ridiculous. So, you know, I didn't. There's plenty of criticism, and you know, there's exposure of his flaws, a little bit of sarcasm here and there. But on the whole, I certainly felt like you know, I should be doing something to redress some of the criticisms of Leary and to try to clarify his life story in a reasonably positive way.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's totally, you're totally right that it's no, like, candy colored greeting card by any stretch of the imagination, but I actually appreciate the way the defense of him is kind of explicit, because it makes you realize how weighted the images are of him, or the ideas of him, even among people who are sympathetic to the counterculture, who are interested in the ideas he put forward, or interested in psychedelic culture, in transhumanism. There's this kind of, you know, this nimbus of a sort of, you know, a corny huckster, an egomaniac, a sociopath, a liar, da 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 da. And, you know,
I think those
you
are
know,
two of the 24 Timothy Learys that you mentioned.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's in there. You know, there's elements of all that.
But what are the sort of errors or the things that are missed in, I think, the kind of conventional image of him? What are the most important, or let's put it another way, of those 24 Timothy Learys that he talked about, what are the ones that you wanted most to bring forward or that you think have the most importance today for people, you know, thinking about some of these topics?
Well, he was extremely well-educated and serious about a whole plethora. I mean, he was a well-read, well-studied generalist in dozens of different areas. You know, of course, particularly psychology, but a lot of the sciences. You know, he was pretty lucid thinker about socio-political relations and so forth. Not so hot on knowing history and politics itself, but very strong on the way humans broadly interact with each other, and also very strong in a person-to-person sense in what is required to challenge a person to, you know, with his friends, to bring a person up, to encourage them. So, I mean, those are aspects. Also, a shocking sincerity sometimes. Hanging out with him, you know, I mean, when I came to Leary because I was interested in his ideas, but I kind of expected to, you know, find him a full-on trickster, you know, and he appears sort of slick when you see him on TV or even when you see him talk, there's a sheen to him, it's like a politician almost. And you sort of expect that that's the way he is. And for the most part, person to person, that's not the way he is, and he's not really trying to be that way when he's on TV or speaking to an audience or whatever. If you think he's fooling around about some of the things he says he believes, and you start talking about it, you realize very quickly he's not fooling around, and he would get kind of upset that you thought that he was.
What are the things you talk about that you bring forward about his character was his just profound ability to interact with people, like how good he was on an individual level and also on a social psychological level. I mean, I know one of the things that's interesting about he had a phenomenal memory for people, for names, for stories about, you know, he'd meet you like 3 years later and go, oh, yeah, hey, how's that thing going, da-da-da-da.
Right.
And, you know, he had this, like, almost kind of supernaturally social awareness that enabled him to connect with people, and at the same time, he had that kind of analytic, psychologist, deconstructive way of looking at human relationships. And I think one of the things you try to do in the book, and I think is really important, and I've done some writing on this as well, is going back to his, you know, pre-psychedelic days as a straight and quite dynamic and in some ways really important mainstream psychologist working on social psychology and the roles we adapt in interpersonal relations and the possibilities we have of changing those games, with even that particular metaphor of the game being something that was very important to him, you know, long before he read Gurdjieff or was thinking about, you know, psychedelic reality creation or anything like that. So can you give us a little bit more of your sense of how the ideas that he came up with as a professional psychologist before the psychedelic experimentation and his transformation into a guru, what's the most important aspect of those ideas, and how did they in some ways set up a lot of what was going to come later on?
Yeah, well, right. He was a transactional psychologist. He was sort of at the on the cusp between behavioral psychology and sort of Maslowian transcendental human potential psychology. And he really mapped out how people fit themselves into social interactions. You know, he really preceded the concept of games people play, which became a very popular 1964 book, and that just follows him right through. I mean, his first psychedelic trip, his first insight as he's coming on is how funny people's social poses were, right? He's looking at a nerdy fellow who is there keeping notes on the group tripping on psilocybin by poolside, and he starts laughing at him, and then he starts laughing at himself, and he laughs at all the different social roles that people construct for themselves. And then, you know, come years later, as young people are rebelling against being forced to fit into these social constructs, and he says, turn on, tune in, drop out. By drop out, he means drop out of the social constructs. He doesn't mean, you know, go hang out on Haight Street and beg for spare change or cease all useful activity. He means drop out on the belief in the social constructs that that dominate people's lives and identities. And it keeps running through all his work. He gets into the Eighth Circuit brain, the so-called Eighth Circuit brain, and the lower surface of the brain, the so-called mammalian behaviors of human beings, again, easily conflate with the work he's doing in the 1950s. So, I mean, in some sense, nothing changed. He was still that same guy, noticing patterns of behavior and how people fit themselves into different roles, you know, and then he got into imprinting and so forth, the idea that we imprint roles at different stages of vulnerability so that when we're really young, we imprint our sense of safety or threat in the world and so on, and then we imprint how we will relate to physical space and mobility, and then we imprint how we deal with symbols and language, and finally we imprint our social and sexual roles. All that stuff follows him right through his career. There's really, I mean, towards the end, he's sort of using that kind of stuff while hanging out with people, but I don't think he's writing about it as much towards the end. But it pretty much follows him throughout.
Well, and let me ask you a question about that too. If in your research, was he doing much kind of cross-referencing with Dr. Lilly? Because a lot of, I don't know if you've read that Programming and Metaprogramming, the biocomputer book.
Yeah.
A lot of it is very similar to those. It's those, the programs that we get, the imprints and the constructs and how to, like, shift them using the psychedelics specifically. So just the fact, what, were they both really working on it separately at the same time, or were they having interaction with each other?
I think, I mean, they were coming up with a lot of this stuff separately. And Tim read the Programming and Metaprogramming in the Human Biocomputer book when it came out. I think it was in 1973 or somewhere around there. And, I mean, he loved it. He was very influenced by it. I don't know that the same thing happened in reverse. I think John Lilly was very much off on his own thing. I think John Lilly was much more of an isolated person, and that his take on the whole thing was much more interior, whereas Tim's take on it tended to be really social. So if he was talking about the effects of psychedelic drugs on the human biocomputer, it would really be about the effects of technology on human beings broadly, and vice versa. And then it might be somewhat about the really deeper interior work, but mostly it would be social observations and, you know, brief but lucid discussions of brain states, you know, transcendent or post-terrestrial or whatever brain states. But, you know, he would leave it up to you to fill in a lot of those blanks, whereas somebody like John Lilly really gave you his trips, as did Terrence McKenna. I mean, Leary gave you some of his trips, particularly in High Priest in the late 1960s. But even though
right.
they were social, they were funny. You know, they were about his son coming in and thinking the dog is dead because he's sleeping, and all these tripping adults thinking, "Oh my God, the dog is dead," and then the dog gets up and walks away. You know, that kind
right.
of a lot of that kind of stuff that happens when people are, you know. In that state,
One of the things this raises for me is just, you know, I think part of the reason that you're going to see figures like Lilly and Timothy Leary and many, many, many others, especially around this time, post-World War II, the emergence of cybernetics, the dominance of psychotherapy, and then the development of newer psychological models, many of which are even more sort of distanced and almost analytic, and then the introduction of media and psychedelics. What that all leads to is a profound sense on many different levels as the society of the constructedness of who we are, of who we think we are. That it's not some natural thing, it's not something that's just given, that it's a product of social processes, of childhood experiences, of the ways our culture, you know, shapes our minds, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of what, you know, people are discovering is like, oh my God, I don't have to be this way. I can be a different way. There's a different way to be. This is a game. We can play a different game. Of course, that raises this big problem, is that if you take apart the given game, because you see it's unhelpful, it's not fun, it's cruel, for any number of reasons, what do you replace it with? And this is a really big conundrum, and people try to answer it in different ways, because you get into this thing of, like, you know, what's the new order? What's the new norm? And he had a very strong sense, a very optimistic, but a kind of almost existentially optimistic perspective of what you replace this with, what the main values are, these qualities of joy, of hedonism, of connecting with others, of play. Talk a little bit about where those values came from, where the sense of what he thought people should do once they've discovered how much they're constructed, once they realize they can remap and change, where they, you know, how he came up with the values of where he thought people should be looking towards in terms of becoming more fully embodied humans or post-humans.
Well, I mean, for starters, he was even a bit of a hedonist in the 1950s. I mean, within the context of Harvard, you know, in the psychology department, he was the guy with the big smile. He and Richard Albert actually became Ram Dass. They were the guys with the big smile and the jug of wine who the graduate students could go to after hours and hang out with. So he had a sort of preternatural sense of enjoyment, kind of optimism, mixed with a weird existential pessimism. And he studied psychotherapy, psychology, and came to the conclusion that nothing worked. He could get, I mean, there's this strong streak almost of nihilism that runs through some of his stuff. Like, you know, his first really strong LSD trip, where he realizes that everything is kind of a sham, you know, and that we're in this sort of Einsteinian matrix of just flashing on-off signals and, you know, energy waves, where he says, well, what can we possibly do? You know, you can just sort of sink into a sad Buddha smile and know that there's not much you can do. So, I mean, there's sort of a seesaw with him between almost a sort of nihilistic existentialism and this sort of preternatural sense of wonder, of joy in the world, of possibility. And, I mean, he becomes very interested in pagan ideas, I think, starting in the 60s, mixed in with you know, totally promiscuous, as everything's there. The Eastern religions are there. Sufism is there. Gurdjieff is there. Paganism is coming in. And, I mean, then you have the hippie culture, which is sort of naturally pagan, and you have sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and he likes that. And so, I mean, he consciously evokes pagan ideas throughout his career. And where that comes from, I don't know. He just that was part of his nature, I think.
How do you, at this point, this is in a way taking a slightly different tack away from Larry that we'll come back to him, but I mean, one of the senses I had, you know, reading through the book and then seeing how he brought his sensibility into this, you know, period of cultural, you know, production that you and I shared a lot with the sort of moment of virtual reality and the emergence of the internet as a kind of a space of imaginings, of possibilities, you know, and the sort of now in some ways kind of quaint cyberpunk moment that looks very, you know, peculiar in a lot of ways from our current moment. But just on a larger level, how that hedonic philosophy, how that sense of pursuing joy and pleasure and amusement and creative possibility, that now as you've seen the sort of legacy of those ideas and those attempts in the hippie culture, in political culture, in cyber culture, just you personally, you've watched this and you've understood the philosophical dimension of it. It's not just about partying. It's something much deeper than that. And yet, it's very confusing now, I think, to wrestle with this legacy, to see is it still applicable, in what ways is it still applicable, and where are its blind sides? So I just really love to hear you reflect for yourself on the way in which that aspect of his legacy is both complicated and or still available in our sort of not very hedonic world in some ways.
Yeah, I think it's very much complexified and often feels like what we might call hedonics or bohemian enjoyment is almost vouchsafed only for the plutocracy, that there's an austerity of economics, but also sort of a deeper sense, an austerity of culture in some ways being imposed upon us, in which, all space, all cerebral space, all virtual space is owned or cordoned off or partly privatized or whatever, and of course we are omni surveilled, totally surveilled. We live in a war culture, so I think that the idea of hedonics as sort of a cool countercultural thing is under heavy manners right now. It's something that can be preserved. I hope this book helps to preserve it, because I don't think that the alternative to austerity is another form of revolutionary severity. I think that it calls for rebooting the hedonic spirit when we can, and if we can, when we can push back the austere conditions that we're currently being subjected to. So, I think it's become very difficult. And, of course, the whole thing with the cyberspace, which seemed like a very liberating area for exploration, and Tim was in some ways lucky to pass in 1996 before it became cordoned, colonized by advertising, and then by Facebook, really turned into a sort of Disneyland community. He was lucky in a way to miss all that. But Tim, let's face it, he painted in really broad strokes, and he was looking at it in a McLuhanistic sense that the media that you use ultimately changes how human beings interact and how they perceive the world and so forth. And, he's looking in terms of Gutenberg and the creation of print books and then the creation of one-way media, radio and television, and then the creation of omnidirectional, all-available communications media to everybody and how that changes everything. I don't think he was wrong about that. I think he just underestimated the complexities and the difficulties that we might undergo during that process. And he was always a utopian. I am one of the things that surprises me as I reread through some of his works is how willing he is to call himself utopian. And that's I would say that's very unfashionable in credible intellectual circles right now, and I tend to steer clear of utopianism because it seems like totalism to me. It seems I think that no matter what we try and what we do, we should recognize that there's going to be a shadow, there's going to be some weirdness, and in fact that's what makes it interesting and makes it human. And utopian systems are probably a little totalitarian. And Tim was a great anti-authoritarian also, but either he didn't think that through or he viewed it differently than
Tim. Well, that's what's interesting, because on the one hand, you have someone who, like you said, is very nihilistic, and kind of like gives up on humanity in some ways. Just looking at the kind of fatalism of it all, and then he's like a fatalist utopian or something, you know, and just that he is obviously into communities and being social and examining social structures and how we interact with each other. I mean, it's not like he was some guru on a mountain and, you know, was doing all this stuff very internally. He was sharing all of it with other people. So what I find fascinating is that maybe he was really a true utopian, because even through the problems and discord that he witnessed within society, with authority and all of that, he still was able to call himself that. So that's kind of amazing. And that, to me, kind of just states how deeply he believed there was some kind of underlying thing in humanity that could possibly, like, pull through this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he believed in evolution, and he believed that evolution hadn't ended with the 20th century human being. I mean, he believed in literal evolution, and, you know, which is a whole other discourse, a whole other discussion as to whether that's something that's already affected by the existence of exterior technology like the internet, or whether that's sort of a transhumanist thing where we're in the middle stage and eventually we'll become post-human, we'll actually become a different creature, or we will create different creatures from ourselves in the technium or whatever. But I mean, he believed in evolution, and you're right, he also you know, he was sort of the head of a commune at Millbrook, and he, you know, despite crazy experiences and being at the center of several social scenes, he liked being around human beings, which I guess, you know, is one aspect maybe of being utopian.
You brought up a lot of great stuff. I really want to ask especially about the transhumanist legacy, but we're going to take a break now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maji Daou. We're talking with author Are You Serious? About his new book on Timothy Leary, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maji Daou here with the lovely Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Are You Serious? About Timothy Leary. And, yeah, let's talk about the transhumanism stuff a little bit, Ran. I mean, you want to, because as some people may or may not know, he believed in this stuff so deeply that he, you know, catered his death according to some of the legend. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of how he died and wanted to get into the cryogenics and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, around 1974, he really became one of the first conscious transhumanists with a voice in the world, when he decided that the human future, the goals that should define a human future, were space migration, intelligence increase, and life extension. And particularly, I mean, the space migration became the linchpin of a movement that really never came to fruition in the 1970s. But the intelligence increase, and particularly the life extension, became the obsessions of this new movement, which became extropianism and then became known as transhumanism. And Leary signed up for cryonics with one of the cryonics groups, I think quite early on, actually. I think he was signed up by the 1980s, and he was one of their celebrities, basically, that they were hoping would help to promote their cause, as ambiguous as having Timothy Leary as your promoter may be in, you know, the broad political spectrum. He was no Ted Williams, but he was signed up for cryonics. I think very few people in his inner circle were turned on by cryonics. Even within people who were turned on by the idea of broadening the lifespan, broadening the health span, increasing intelligence, different ways of evolving, cyborgizing the human being, expanding our communications continuum, going into space, all those things. The whole corpuscle thing did not appeal to a lot of people. But he was quite earnest about it. And then right towards the end, as he had prostate cancer, he made a huge public thing out of his process of dying. He announced that he was dying. He threw a house party, an open house party, very active dying of prostate cancer lifestyle with lots of visitors, lots of media coming through doing interviews and so forth. At some point, he decided, I mean, he was so enamored of what was going on with this new world of websites and what was happening online, he decided he would die on the Internet. He would self-euthanize on the Internet. Or he threw that out there anyway. He said, I think in a conversation with Ken Kesey, as he often does without discussing it with anybody, he just kind of said, yeah, I'm going to die on the Internet. And this bothered the people who were running his cryonics thing, because it's illegal to self-euthanize, and they were already feeling like he was turning his life into a Fellini-esque circus. His death, his dying process, which I thought was great. I mean, it was wonderful that he...
he was included. He did everything with people. Like, he had a communal death.
He was dying. Why not drop acid and take a bunch of kids on wheelchairs and run around Beverly Hills? You know, why not have an outrageous, you know, crazy, surreal, burlesque dying process, but some people can relate to it. The chronics people sort of came and gave him a dressing down, saying, you know, there are certain types of behaviors that aren't working for us, and he threw them out with their cryonics unit. And the unit was right there in the house, so that he could be put on ice as soon as he passed. And he decided not to go through with that. And he told Ken Kesey that he thought he had sort of squeezed life dry. That in his 75 years, I think he said, I've had enough of the particular pleasures of this planet. I think he realized that he'd squeezed his 1,000 years into 75 and didn't need to hang on. Some people like to say he had some kind of spiritual or religious breakthrough, that he realized that there was something after. Who knows? He liked to tell people what they wanted to hear sometimes, so it's hard to tell whether that was the real thing or not.
It's really interesting, especially reading his encapsulated life story, how much, because I'm very interested in a way, particularly when people die, and how they represented who were public figures, and particularly it seems to me that psychedelic and spiritual figures have sort of an extra opportunity to sort of model a different attitude towards death than most of us have in our really, you know, very problematic relationship with death in our society. And but the thing about Leary too, in addition to just the way that he played it, you know, in many ways in a sort of typical Leary-esque manner, lots of people, big party, media, very outgoing, kind of outrageous, crazy optimism. It also links in with some of the initial stories that you tell in his life story, particularly his first LSD trip, which is very much a very, very significant trip, which you cite at length for good reason, because it really is it's a foundational experience for him, and that's the one we referred to earlier, the kind of nihilistic trip where everything is a sham. And an element of seeing through that sham was just seeing through being into a kind of bardo, where it's like, he's dead, the people are dead, we're all just dead, repeating ourselves meaninglessly, unable to recognize the greater life that the universe holds for us beyond the limited robotic framework of our individual personalities. And this basic idea, which you point out very rightly, was his own experience. It's not the way things are. His own experience had this, you know, death and rebirth framework in terms of the ego, in terms of coming through psychedelic experience, which he then sort of imprinted on psychedelic culture, book, The Psychedelic Experience, which looks at the Tibetan Book of the Dead and takes that model of dying and rebirth as a model for psychedelic experience. So this idea of death and what happens in the face of it, what happens beyond it, what happens through a death-like experience, really runs through his whole story. And I hadn't really put those different moments together in the way I did after until I read your book and how where you have this nice arc of his life. But I'd like to hear you expand a little bit on your comment on that first very significant LSD trip he has, where he sees through the sham of everything and he watches TV, which is like the worst thing you could possibly do in this situation. Don't watch bad comedy on TV unless you really want to go for a hell ride.
He found that very profound, though. I think he was watching Jack Benny and two other people. And somehow, within the context of the skit, which, of course, you know, he was only comprehending on the level of people saying weirdly profound things and, you know, to a laugh track, somebody who had his back turned to the camera turned around and said, "You've been dead for 2 seconds." And it kind of, you know, sent him on that, "Oh, my goodness, you know. I've skipped a beat. I'm living a life that, you know, is not in tune with the actual rhythm of life, but is one step behind it." And then Doris Day comes on the show and says, "We'll meet again the next time around." And so this all trips him off into the idea that he's out of rhythm with the universe, that perhaps because he hasn't confronted death and rebirth. And finally, I mean, it's not like the trip is a massive bummer. He's not freaking out. He's not jumping out of windows. He's having these sort of revelations. When he goes outside and sees the snow and he sees, you know, the natural moonlight and all that, it brings him back. It brings him back in tune with the current moment. So, I mean, he experiences it as a death rebirth, but he has that even previous to that. He has a non-psychedelic death rebirth experience in 1959, just before he becomes the psychedelic guy, because he gets very sick and he goes to Spain, and he just keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and then somehow he lets it all go. He cuts off all ties to everything, all his ambitions and all his attachments. And he gets better. He wakes up the next morning feeling better. He lets the energy just kind of pass through him, sort of a life energy pass through him. So he even has a death rebirth experience before psychedelics, and that becomes his theme throughout the series. And then I think with the hippie thing, with the counterculture, with the youth culture, I think he stops talking about the death experience so much until he becomes obsessed with the idea of not dying, which is one way of confronting death. I mean, compared to not talking about death at all, becoming an immortalist or becoming a life extender is a way of actually, it shows that at least you're thinking, you're remembering that this is where the mortal trip ends. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
no, it's all very interesting reflection. I mean, I'm just really interested in that moment, and then also, I mean, you didn't spend a lot of time with with his book, the Psychedelic Experience, which he writes with Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner, and comes out in 1964, which is a very interesting book because in a way it's very dated. It's very hard to sort of like extract a lot of really sort of substantial insight given the kind of level of discourse around psychedelics and around spiritual experience today, and yet it was a very, very influential book, and a lot of people took it very seriously, and it's a really important book, and I think in some ways a really fascinating one. And so I'm kind of curious about how you fit that book into his his sort of larger arc of his career.
I think, Abby, I think his turn towards his interest in the Eastern religions is to me, it looks sort of like a detour from his main through lines, which are the scientific exploration of, you know, the psychological exploration of games and you know, human evolution and those kinds of processes, and his question of authority, which begins in when he's involved in the psychology field, where he feels that there shouldn't be an hierarchical structure between the people in the psychology field and the so-called nervous people. He doesn't like calling them patients. He calls them nervous people who come for help, that it should be non-hierarchical and shared and so forth. So the Eastern stuff, I mean, you know, there's certainly the dropping of all games in the context of Buddhism, in the context sometimes of Hinduism and so forth. So it might fit in that way. But in some ways, it seems to me, and I know it seemed to him like somewhat of a detour. And it was sort of the first thing that they could latch onto when they looked around to see who was having experiences and who was commenting on experiences where everything dissolved, and you know, your ego kind of flew out the window, and you entered this other space that was non-physical or seemingly non-physical or deeper into the physical, into you know, the Einsteinian energy and so forth. I think it was something that, to Tim, it was something that they sort of grabbed at as, you know, sort of the first rung on this level of you know, on the in the path of understanding the psychedelic experience. But I'd be curious if you have another take on it.
Well, I mean, I think that you're correct that in terms of the arc of his career, that it was in some ways, and certainly he saw it that way, as a kind of detour, because it didn't, you know, I think it fundamentally he's a very Western figure, both in terms of his relationship to science and his relationship to the individual and the potential, the human potential of the individual, outside of a kind of, you know, he talks about like the custard mush of Hinduism, the sort of, you know, all is one goo, which is just not as dynamic in a lot of ways as the world that he's putting forward. But it's really interesting, again, when you think about the kind of prophetic element or the anticipatory element that he has, that it's in the early 1970s when the political and radical dreams of the counterculture are fading rapidly into a somewhat depressing time. It's at that time when you have hordes of ex-hippies and young people turning towards Eastern religions, turning towards what we call cults, turning towards gurus and swamis and, you know, the occasional self-help leader, you know, on the Western side of things. But it's at this moment when he's, you know, going through his totally insane life, but also spending a lot of time in prison, that he makes this transhumanist turn where he really largely, though not exclusively, not entirely, but largely abandons the kind of strong religious or spiritual aspect of his 60s approaches, and really embraces, when very few people are doing it, these, you know, images of intelligence expansion, space flight, extraterrestrial intelligence, but in this kind of science fictional vein of sort of utopian philosophy with science, but still it's not quite real science. It's like it has a visionary kind of quality to it. Why do you think that happened then in his life, in the early 70s, when he's in prison a lot of the time? What was it that because a lot of you could look at that the same story and say, okay, here's the point where he becomes profoundly depressed. Here's the point where he holds on, you know, with every force of his being to the models that he had already been using, or the counterculture or spirituality. But no, he does something very conceptually radical.
It's such a complex set of insights that he had, or projections that he had, with Eighth Circuit theory and with all the ways he reflected on that in the five books called the Future History series. I mean, it's so rich and so much fun, so playful. that I think it's hard to say that it came out of depression. It came out of isolation and the fact that he had time to think about it. And, I mean, it also came out of his alienation from the terrestrial human behaviors and the get-the-heretic kind of things that go on in ordinary human societies, you know, that happened not just with the federal government, but with the Black Panther Party or you know, with the FBI or with the people who think he's selling out to the FBI and all that sort of stuff. He's looking for ways to transcend, to take, I mean, the entire society, or at least those who choose to, into a place where they are able to transcend the territorial and the sort of conflict-ridden nature of human interaction. And he starts to think of it in terms of biology and what people are starting to understand about evolutionary biology and the existence of reward circuits in the brain. And I think, you know, that he understands that human beings have these reward circuits in the brain that reward success, that reward aggression, you know, it's like a cocaine rush or whatever. And he starts to wonder, why are these other reward circuits in the brain? Why does it feel so good to have these psychedelic experiences? Why is the sudden onrush of too much information, of the brain firing in these extraordinary ways, and the having of these strange, challenging visions? Why is it pleasurable? You know, why is this a pleasure? And I think it's in that context that he starts to look at what is the evolutionary use, or what is the evolutionary meaning of this being available to us? And he decides that it must be somewhere in the future. You know, we're kind of, you know, we're useless right now, but when you have a leisure society, when you have a post-scarcity society, and when you're beginning to explore neurological connectedness, and then control over biology and control over the quantum level, then these psychedelic experiences become meaningful in a scientific, evolutionary, Darwinian sense. And I think mostly, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just him thinking. It's just him being in isolation and thinking. And going back to the question about the Eastern stuff, I mean, I think the value that he gets from, you know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the psychedelic experience, his interest in Buddhism and Taoism and so forth, is the ability to let go. You know, I mean, despite constructing these sort of almost rigid evolutionary maps, as a persona, as an individual, and also as a public speaker and so forth, who can be playful and spontaneous and wacky and unafraid of being a little ridiculous once in a while. Maybe that death rebirth stuff, you know, gave him not so much a philosophic, but just an inherent ability to let go. And, you know, letting go is part of enjoying the psychedelic experience, which was something that he never stopped doing in his
life.
Well,
I feel like that really answers part of Eric's question that he asked earlier, which is, once we realize that we have these constructs, once we realize that there's all these, you know, programs and social influence from the media, once we realize all that's in there and get it out, what do we replace it with? It seems like part of the answer is that is evolution, and evolution means something comes from the inside out. So part of that Buddhist stillness and being able to let go is, it's not like we have to replace it with anything. There's something inherently already in there that we just have to allow to express, right? And I kind of feel like there was part of Timothy Leary's experiments and investigations that were all pointing towards that. He got hip to, like, hey, all this stuff is being dumped on us and put on us. Once we clear it out, then what do? Well, you can just kind of sit there and let go and see what happens.
I think that he sort of got back to that in the 90s. You know, I mean, I think that he was very, I don't know how to put this, but sort of on message as a transhumanist, as a cyber person, as an anti-authoritarian, as someone who sort of rejected Eastern philosophy very specifically in the 70s and 80s. And he has that systemic psychological theory thing going on. And then by the 90s, he's talking chaos all the time. And he doesn't want to talk about his eight circuits. He becomes a sort of cyber Taoist in a way, where he is very much willing to surrender to the flow of all things. And, you know, somehow he combines those things. He still continues to be an optimist about the potentials for human evolution and that process happening in the context of technology and science, but he also starts saying chaos, baby, all the time, and is very willing to surrender to the moment and the process of living and dying at the end. So I thought that was a nice sort of coda for his life, actually, that he did sort of become this sort of crazy Taoist at the end. Almost like a punk Taoist when really rigid journalists came to visit him and started asking him all these hard questions about, you know, define this and define yourself this way and define yourself that way. He would start acting like Sid Vicious or something, and, you know, just fuck off.
That's like, great. You know, we got to wrap it up here, RU. I just want to thank you again for being on the show and for writing this book. Again, it's called Timothy Leary's Trip Through Time, and I hope a lot of people read it because I think he still has something to say to us.
Yeah, let's tell them where it's available, timothyleary.org.
Great. Anything else you want to let people know about what you're working on?
Well, I'm still working on the Mondo 2000 book, Use Your Hallucinations. So one of these days that'll be popping out.
Wonderful. That's true. Oh, yeah, one other little quick question. Why hasn't this been made into a film yet? Is somebody holding the rights? His life is so rich. It's got to happen.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, there's people have had rights since he published Flashbacks. Some people have had the rights to that story. The Robert Greenfield sort of really dark version of his life has been sold. But it just keeps on getting passed on from one person to the next. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. I know there's one version of it that ends with him going to jail in the 1960s. I mean, I think the most cinematic part of his life is in the 1970s. But I think people who really like Leary don't know how to deal with the 1970s narrative.
It's a tale that's certainly about as large as life than you can get. Well, thanks again for being on the show.
Okay, thank you, Eric.
All right, from me and Masha to all you out there, keep your minds open.